Feeling-driven.
Willpower.
Hello and welcome to a new episode of Willpower Podcast. My name is Ilaria Biancacci, journalist and founder of Willpower, and I'm here today with Munir Abano, a passionate advocate for women in STEM, senior lecturer in software engineering at Deakin University in Melbourne, superstar of STEM, and member of Equity, Diversity and Inclusion Committee for Science and Technology Australia. Munira was announced as the most influential Asian Australian under 40 in 2019, and she's the Go Girl Go For It 2020 ambassador, with the aim to inspire the next generation of girls in STEM careers. Discover with us her strong commitment to fight and destroy society's gender and cultural assumptions about scientists and women in STEM.
Hello, Munira, and thank you for joining us today in this other edition of Willpower Podcast. Today, we're going to talk about women in STEM, and I would like you to tell a little bit more about your experience, why you decided to pursue a career in science, and what did it mean for you to grow up in Pakistan as a girl, and your transition into the Australian system.
Thank you so much, Ilaria, for giving me this opportunity to share my story with you and your audience. I am a senior lecturer in software engineering at Deakin University, and I am one of the superstar of STEM for Science and Technology Australia, a program that aims to smash the assumptions about the gender for the female scientists in the society to bring more female role models for the next generation of not just the girls, but also boys as well. And also, I am the member of their Equity, Diversity and Inclusion Committee. And I had the honor of being the under 40 most influential Asian Australian for last year. So you ask about my story, how it started. Well, I was born in the capital in Pakistan to a Pashtun family. And my mother, who grew up in the north in Pakhtunkhwa, which is close to the border of Afghanistan. And the area is known very much for the patriarchal culture where the women were denied access to education. I grew up by looking at all the women in my mother's generation, how dependent they were on the men. And men, on the other hand, were given all the, all sorts of opportunities that they want, whatever they wanted in terms of education, in terms of empowerment. Being the last child, having four elder brothers and born in the capital, I think that played out well in the context of my upbringing, that I was given the equal access to education like my brothers, and where I was in the capital, there were no restrictions for girls to education the way it was where my mom was growing up. Watching my brothers as my role models, because I never had the female role models, but just my father and my brothers, they all went into science, and that was the decision that I made as well. I think if there were elder sisters, this would have been a different kind of decision, because I saw that many other girls in the society, they were going either, those who were in the school, there were many, very few who were opting math and science. Mm-hmm. Majority of them were going into arts because they generally accepted the gender stereotypes for the girls, even after the education, is that learn enough because you have to then educate your children. So it means that you just have to be a wife and a mother to look after the family. And being a scientist or an engineer or these kind of professions were kind of, still looked at being from a very male perspective. I opted the science with few other girls, and after the high school, there comes a time when you make a decision what specialization you want to go into the university. That's when I, for the first time, saw that there was a lot of push for me to opt to be a medical doctor, because being a doctor and a nurse is more feminine and nurturing in the nature. And when I just wanted to study computers, was like, the first time, what exactly are you going to do with this qualification? For me, I think at that point that being 16, 17 year old, you don't see the future that far. You just want to know what you're curious about and what you want to learn. Another thing that played out well is that having a profession was optional for me as a woman. So I didn't have to worry about that. Whatever I'm studying, I have to have a profession in that field. So I opted computer science. I did my bachelor's and master's in Pakistan. While I was doing my bachelor's, I got offered to become a research associate at International Islamic University in Islamabad. Teaching was somewhat, you know, an academic career is acceptable once again. And but I was a more of a researcher as well as a, I was doing teaching as well. And that's where I developed a flavor for academic career. And I was teaching computer science subjects in that university. In 2000, and within a few years, I became a permanent lecturer there and then assistant professor. And I decided that I want to, you know, continue with academic career. So by then, I made a choice that I will have a career. But to proceed further, I have to have a PhD. In 2012, I made the decision to come to Australia. That's, I think, was another huge barrier that as a woman from that part of the world, if you are coming without a male chaperone, being a single woman to Australia was quite a number of raised eyebrows. And, you know, there's there was a cultural barrier to that for acceptance. And I have seen other women who, to pursue their dream, they agree to get married in those kind of situations.
Okay.
And I have also seen that those marriages are very difficult because they are arranged in for, I mean, not for the purpose of a relationship, but for, to, you know, means to another end.
Yeah.
And nothing gets achieved in both aspects. I didn't want to get into that kind of scenario. And they were quite a talk that, okay, let her go. She will be back in 1 or 2 months. She won't survive there on her own. I came here 8 years ago, and it was, I think, the most difficult time of my life because there were quite a number of self-doubts I had as well that I couldn't voice because I took the decision against the opposition. And if you tell them, if I have self-doubts, then that's it. Everything fell apart. So not just try to convince myself and look brave, but not to complain about anything that was bothering me here, the homesickness, the cultural shock, not having friends or family around me. Everything was different. I was completely out of my comfort zone. Those few months were very difficult, but I managed, I don't know, with few things that I tried to learn about Australia. I got a few of the friends who were from international cultures, from Iran, but I had some similarities with them in terms of our language and our traditions. I think making those friends, trying to build new comfort zone was something that sustained me. And I am a resilient person as well, regardless of all the stuff that was going on, surrendering to say that I failed in doing something that I have pushed so far and fought for. I wasn't ready to surrender for that as well. So I think that was a difficult period, but I overcame that. And after 3 years, I graduated with a PhD in software engineering. And then by then I made the decision that I will stay and have a career here in Australia. Initially, I was did my postdoc from the same university, University of Technology, Sydney, where I did my PhD. Then in 3 years ago, I was offered a continuing lecturer position here in Melbourne. I moved here, and last year, it's almost 1 year now, I got offer of a senior lecturership here at Deakin University. So it's if you would ask me if I knew from the time I went to the school for the first time that how the life would turn out to be, no. It's just that you just one step at a time and you make decisions of how at that particular point in your life, what you want and what you want to be. So this is how it all came to.
You say that obviously growing up in Pakistan, there were not many role model of women in STEM, women in science and technology you could relate to. Did you have any inspiration, any woman you read about and you wanted to become like her, or someone that inspired you through all your studies and careers? Even could be a living person, not necessarily a...
And she just mentioned, I saw the book right in front of me. So I was, when I was a little child, she became the prime minister. Can you see?
Ah, Benazir Bhutto.
Yes, the book was right in front of me and I saw that. So when I for the first time understood the concept of prime minister in a country, she was the one. So I saw a female leader in the country. So she's not from STEM, or, you know, I couldn't relate to her in many ways, but looking at someone who is a woman in a patriarchal culture on a top position as a head of the state, I think that also breaks for that kind of stereotype in your mind as well. Maybe not in my family, maybe not in my culture, but in the country, there was a woman who at that time was a prime minister, later became prime minister again. So I think she was on television all the time giving interviews. So when you turn on a TV, you see a woman talking to you. So I would say that, yes, there was this perception that I had that it's not impossible for me to get to that kind of situation. But my taste was for different domain.
Yeah.
So you try in that one. So I would say, yes, she was there and she showed everyone how to do it.
And because not every person that is listening to this podcast is probably a scientist, would you like to explain a little bit more what's your research and what your job is related to?
So I'm a software engineer, and I work on the socio-technical side of technology. So how the software, how people interact with it, what do they need to get out of it, how successful it will be to improve the lives of people, what is a good technology and what would be a bad technology. So my whole research is always around the human interaction with the software.
I read an article of yours related to artificial intelligence and the way the algorithm is impacted when there is online hate speech. Would you like to tell me a little bit more about this?
Recently, a few years back, people realized that the idea about the artificial intelligence of being, fair, because it's not correct, because as humans, we think that if we bring in the machines, the machine will demonstrate a very fair behavior based on some set of rules. But the thing is that who define these rules? Humans, in turn. So it's like whatever you're going to tell the computer to do, the computer is going to do that fairly. But if the whole, all the rules around it are defined unfairly, then it won't give you the right output that you want. And another problem is that even if the algorithms are fair, all the rules are created based on fairness, the data that comes into the algorithm is going to define what the output is. So garbage in, garbage out kind of situation. So there were recently some of the algorithms, they take feed from social media data to define the trends, to get some information, look at the global patterns of people's mood, and especially when it comes to the political polling, how people define and how they are talking about certain political leaders. And this all impacts in a larger scheme of things, the what output these algorithms are going to give us. Because then there are user-generated contents that are given back to us and how we understand then the reality. But when we conducted that research, I think the one you are referring to, the hate speech was, the amount of hate that is out there is also part of the data that comes in that needs to be filtered out. But we don't have those kind of ethical frameworks around it. In the name of freedom of speech, a lot gets said in anonymity online. We did the research, I think sexism was the top factor when you try to tag the, we conducted on Twitter only. We didn't go for the Facebook or other, especially there are some unregulated platforms as well. Twitter, you have the option to report or an abuse or they will take it down. And even then, there is a huge amount that goes in the name of sarcasm and jokes. But the problem is that the AI algorithms will not understand them as sarcasm. So even if there were 80 to 90% of the hate speech that we had tagged, it was all jokes or non-threatening. But when you feed that kind of data to an algorithm, it's all constitute of hate speech. So this was something rather remarkable that we as a society needs to understand that whatever we are typing online, it's not going to vanish. It's we are writing a history, and this is going to impact the future. And in turn, these algorithms, when we are having more and more dependence on them in the future, how they are going to make decisions for us, what kind of decisions we want them to make. So everything that I post online, I am responsible for the outcome. So we may not realize it, but eventually it contributes to the statistical generalization of what we are putting out there.
You said before that humans are setting the rules for artificial intelligence and softwares. So my question is, do you think that artificial intelligence is gender biased?
There have been instances where we saw the sexism did play the role in the output. For example, there have been reports of apps created by, because the whole team of developers are men and they try to look at where the revenue could be generated. There was an infamous case of an app that was used for revenge, where a woman's face could be planted on any video, which would be abusive of nature and can be shared on social media platforms. By the time you clarify and find out that it's a fake, the reputation and the damage has been done. It would not do that to the men's body. They were all the shapes of women. So diversity in the development team and what they are doing is also a part. So that when you were saying that we need more women in STEM, we need the counterpart these kind of initiatives and ideas as well. There was another, the very famous example of the Google Translate. I don't know if you have seen that one or not.
Yes, so, I read it.
Yeah, so it's a very simple, basic way of making someone understand what biases in data can do. So if you translate it to Persian or Turkish from English, some gender nouns with specific roles, like she's president and he's cooking, translate it to Persian or Turkish and then translate back, because now the algorithm has to decide the gender for those roles. It's always he's president and she's cooking, because the statistical generalization at the back end shows that these roles have to be with this specific gender. So, and then Alexa has been shown that 67% of the users said that it would not respond to a female voice. Ironically, all these voice assistant systems, majority of them have female voice themselves. So, I mean, this all comes from the fact that you, sometimes it's not intentional. When you point out to the companies, they do try to come up with a solution to address this problem. But if you don't have the diversity in the software development team that can cater to these different issues, or if they are not conscious about these things, this is what the technology, I mean, once again, we as humans, we define the rules. If the rules are coming from very homogeneous cohort of developers with not having a diversity in the data, then this is what happens in the results.
What is the situation like for women and girls that want to study or pursue a career in STEM in Australia?
So, because I came to Australia to do a PhD, and we were already in minority in engineering and IT faculty, we didn't have the problem of cultural diversity, because mostly in engineering and IT faculty, there were more international students. The problem was of the gender. So at university level, there were quite a number of initiatives to appreciate if I, as a woman, I would move forward or I would show some interest in different things. And in terms of job and then becoming superstar of STEM, all of these were like initiatives which were given to us, a door opening kind of situation as a woman. So there were quite a number of opportunities in Australia as a woman for me to move forward. I haven't been, like, my education as a girl was in Pakistan when I was growing up. So I'm not much familiar about the actual context or the circumstances currently the girls would have, because I do interact with them. They show some, I would say, motivation to go into the fields, but then they have some reservations as well. So we try, these programs are trying to inspire the girls themselves to make this decision that they want to study science or technology or mathematics, and why it is important to have more girls. So we do school outreach activities, going and talking to these girls and trying to show them what a female scientist looks like. They have this image in their head that it would be a nerdy kind of, you know, boring kind of person. So we try to break that stereotype that science is fun. You don't have to be a boring person. You can be fun and still be a scientist as well. So, so far my experience with the girls here in Australia had been amazing, but I haven't been through that system myself. My experience as a school girl was all in Pakistan, which was a very different culture and different context.
And looking back at your country, would you like to do something there? Some programs there for the girls in STEM, or are you actually doing something already?
Because my I'm an academic at the university level, so I do interact with the women in Pakistan who are either researchers or want to continue further their career by doing PhD. So I do counseling, mentoring, I give talks, I interact with them whenever I'm going home. I visit different universities there as well. So I do try to encourage them that some of them, when they have self-doubts or they want to even share their circumstances with me to seek guidance. It's nothing like official, but it's on personal level. I have connected in the past few years with a lot of women from that part of the world, not just now Pakistan, it's India, Bangladesh, and other countries as well, because there are some cultural similarities across that area, which they find difficult to overcome. And sharing my story and telling them how I did what I did in certain circumstances, if they could relate to me, I'm more than happy to directly talk to them and share those experiences.
Did you left Pakistan in 2012, so now it's been 8 years. Is there any difference? Did you notice any difference in the system, an improvement, a raise of awareness?
When I left Pakistan, there was no group called Pakistani Women in Computing. So a few years ago, I got invited for one of the workshops to participate in it. And it was great to see that the women were coming together, creating alliances and networks to, you know, bring strength to their voices that they were raising and giving others opportunities to grow and move forward as well. That was something I was really pleased to see, because this was not available at the time when I was there. And when I came, I think I was the only one who came who was as a single Pakistani woman in my faculty. Now I see there are a lot more women coming on their own. Nothing against marriage, but it's just that don't get into the relationship for wrong reasons. They surrender to pressure. And it's just like I said before, then things get complicated and you don't pursue your dream as well as you are in a relationship where you're not happy. That would not work. So that was another change that I was happy to see, that there were more women who were taking stance and coming here on their own.
And you mentioned at the very beginning that you won the most influential Asian Australian under 40 in 2019. What did it mean to you, and how did you feel in that moment?
Look, that award was something that was verification of my commitment. When I moved here, like when I finished my PhD, I heard some of the people, they were trying to, one of them wanted to try to change the name to have, you know, a Western name, so that the chances of employability will increase. If you have a Munira is a Middle Eastern name, Arabic, Banu is a Persian name. And they were discussing in front of me that, you know, if you change your name, it's easy to pronounce here in Australia. And also there were, you know, some suggestions of going and changing your accent to Australian way of talking. For me, all of that was like, I'm not going to change who I am. And just for the sake of employment, why would you want to work for someone who cannot see actual value of you as a person beyond your name and accent? I would rather, you know, earn less, but I would work for someone who see me as a human and value who I am. Mm-hmm. And eventually you will find the right people to hang out with. And that under 40 Asian Australian Award was one of the proof that with the same name, with the same, as the same person, you could make it to that point. Be authentic and be yourself. Don't surrender to the pressure to changing yourself. As an Asian Australian, I bring the value to the Australian society, and it was appreciated. And that was a huge honor and a very big privilege for me.
If there was a message you would like to share with all the girls and women that are listening to us right now, and they would like to pursue a career in STEM, but they still have doubts or fears, what would be?
For me, it all comes down to how much conviction you have on what you want to achieve. As long as, like, I was convinced that I wanted to do PhD, I wanted to come to Australia or, you know, do the thing. And I was convinced I was ready to put up with anything that was coming my way, all the difficulties, all the challenges, because the decision was mine. I was convinced that I had to do it. If it's your decision, you're convinced, then any hardship is just, you know, an obstacle in the way that you will find a way around. But if you have doubts, you don't have that kind of conviction, the hurdles will set you back. So first of all, try to find your sense of purpose. Why are you doing whatever you are doing? And within STEM field, you need to bring that motivation and sense of pleasure. But because if you are happy what doing what you're doing, it's not like work. It's like living your life through that career. So I enjoy what I do as a researcher when I teach. So that most of the time, I would say it doesn't feel like work. It's like, this is my life. This is who I am. And that's how I live. So because in the end, the job satisfaction and happiness precedes everything.
Thank you one more time to Munira for being with us today. Remember that if you want to discover more inspiring and powerful stories, you can visit www.wempower.co, where you can also buy a membership to support our journalism. Follow us on social media at Wempower UK. And don't forget that together we empower women. My name is Ilaria Biancacci for Wempower Podcast. Until next time.